of sights to rest my eyes in shades of green.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Gordon Ross Thompson, Professor Emeritus, Skidmore College. He has taught classes on the music of India, popular music culture, and media studies. And tonight we are continuing our conversation about 60s British pop outside in, this time, Volume 2, Ichigo Park, 1964 to 1970. Gordon, welcome back to the show. It is a pleasure to talk about these two volumes.
Great to be back with you, Mark.
Now, is it just my imagination, or is there an awful lot more in Volume 2?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the material that's in Volume 2 reflects British pop's coming of age. In Volume 1, we see them imitating Americans and looking really focused at the American market and trying to shape things specifically for the American market by trying to be American. That's why the first volume is called Downtown. It's about New York. This volume, they basically come of age. They realize, oh, wait a minute, we do our own thing.
Yeah.
We have our own way of doing pop music. And the Americans love when we do British pop. So they really come of age. So the book starts actually talking about two sets of songwriters, Graham Gouldman, who was writing for the Yardbirds and Herman's Hermit and the Hollies, and of course Lennon and McCartney. And these songwriters are really coming up with some new musical ideas that are, you could say, really now distinctly and consciously British.
Yeah, especially when I think about Lennon's sort of interest, and each of the Beatles on their White Album, they started to experiment with all sorts of stuff. I can remember when that album came out, which was a double album. People were weirded out by some of the stuff on that White Album.
Yeah,
and then number
nine still weirds people out. It's funny now, you know, I've listened to that so many times I now kind of understand how that kind of put together. I can kind of anticipate how things are going to happen. But there's also some really fun stuff on there, but it also reflects all the different directions that Lennon, McCartney, and Harrison were going at that point in time.
I find it hard to believe, and I know it's true. Not only did you write it in the book, but I've talked to people about it, that Abbey Road is everybody's favorite Beatle album. Is it yours?
It is really popular. It's like my kids. I don't have a favorite. They're all my favorites.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Although from the impact, I have to say Sgt. Pepper's, because when that came out, that changed everything.
Well, you know, but you can kind of say that about each of the albums, and you have to. I'm also thinking about the British release, not the American release.
Yep.
I've got friends that their whole orientation towards the Beatles is through the American releases. But my perspective comes to it. I've looked at the British stuff so often, that really makes a lot of sense. But each of those albums, like the first album, Please Please Me, that was kind of earth-shaking in terms of British pop in Britain. And then, you know, the album A Hard Day's Night, wow, just some great stuff on there. Beatles for Sale, wow. And then, of course, Rubber Soul and Revolver. Revolver, each of these albums just takes it up a notch.
Yep.
So that, you know, they get, and you know, have to look at it from the standpoint of the Beatles. What are they going to do after this? What are they going to do after Sgt. Pepper?
I know.
Well, they've got all these ideas. They've been sitting in India writing stuff, coming up with new ideas, but also going off in their own directions. And then, you know, Abbey Road is a great album. I've played in a band where we cover the medley at the end, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, this is fun. This is just fun.
You mean, and in the end, Love You Make is equal to love.
The whole string of
it's amazing.
There.
Well, you know, when you put both of your books, both of the volumes of 60s British pop outside in together, it really is. There's a lot of stories, but it really traces the whole arc of the Beatles.
Yeah, it follows the Beatles. It's interesting how we get to 1969, and the Beatles fall apart.
Yeah,
the Labor government loses the election. There's this shift. 1970, the things just start. Well, you can also say from 68, but things start falling apart. As the poem says, the center does not hold.
Yeah.
But 1966, everybody says London. That's swinging London. That's the place to be. Britain has come of age. So this second volume is about that coming of age and the really sophisticated material that songwriters are coming up with.
Oh, yeah.
And the interesting mixes of musical styles.
First of all, the term is high 60s has been used by people before. And this is, as you write, is the apogee of the era's cultural revolution. And there were so many things that went on. Were there as many technological advances in the second half of the 60s as there was in the first half? I know that one of the things that I remember
a huge change.
And that allowed people to do all sorts of wild stuff.
Yeah, the huge change is the introduction of 8-track recording that in 67, 68. British songwriters and producers and engineers had been working with 2 tracks and 3 tracks and 4 track. So, with the Beatles, that second album, they start shifting over to 4-track from just, working with 2 and 3 track. And suddenly they have all these opportunities. We get to the White Album and Ken Scott is now setting up when they go to sit down and record While My Guitar Gently Weeps. And they bring in Eric Clapton to play, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've asked Ken. Ken's a friend. I've asked Ken, what do you remember about that session? And he is really coy about that. He says, I don't remember it because George Harrison had wandered down a hall at Abbey Road and seen these boxes of recording equipment that he knows is 8-track equipment. And he insists that Ken set it up, even though the bigwigs at Abbey Road said, no, you're not supposed to do that. It has to be all tested and all set up first by our in-house engineers. George Harrison, it's the Beatles. They say do something at Abbey Road. Ken's going to do it.
Right.
So he spends most of that recording session literally with his head inside that machine trying to figure out, how do I make this work? How do I get this to a mixing board? How do I interface this with the equipment we have? How do I work up things like playback? How do I handle all of that stuff? What do I do? How do I handle this new equipment? But the 8-track really suddenly changes things. That's why when we get to Ballad of John and Yoko, Paul and John can do the whole thing, because they've now got these 8-tracks and they can dub all the stuff themselves.
This is also seems like the beginning of much longer cuts on albums and theme albums. Like when I think about bands and you write about these Moody Blues, we're talking about an entire album having an idea, having a theme that's playing into each other. So it's like the beginning of prog rock.
Well, it is. Absolutely. Although I doubt that... Well, I'm not sure how the Moody Blues would feel about being called prog rock, but I guess
they are. They're prog rock. That's
That Days of Future Past is really remarkable piece of work. An interface between a band and an orchestra.
I know.
With a music director who's doing orchestrations and things like that to help them. Takes a lot of sensitivity on both sides to make that kind of thing work. But you're also getting, Pink Floyd, the early Pink Floyd, Sid Barrett, Pink Floyd era, where there are just kind of like these extended improvisations, which is something different at that stage than the prog rock. The prog rock, it's really kind of feeding up. So by the time we get to the end of the decade, we've got, Pete Townshend working on Tommy as an album.
Yep.
And Ray Davis working on, Arthur. It's just this suddenly, they see that, hey, we can do big things and bring in big themes. The Herd referencing, Divine Comedy. It's like, you know.
Well, and a Whiter Shade of Pale, referencing Chaucer.
Yeah, well, Whiter Shade, absolutely. It was some fun stuff in it. Yeah, of course, referencing Chaucer, but also one of the more, how do we say it, spicy elements of Canterbury Tales.
That's right. It's one of the great tales.
Yes. But, yeah, it's funny, you know, and I talked with Matthew Fisher, the organist from Procol Harum in that era. And we were talking about the songs that they did and about, you know, the kind of like the new perspective. And I quoted, you know, Jan and Dean talking about their perspective on music was teens don't give a blank about, you know, about the words. They only want a good beat. And Matthew says, well, no, that's not true.
No.
I still have people coming up to me and asking, what does it all mean? Like there's some great secret back there. But yeah, there's a really big shift in the way that musicians and producers are thinking about music, and also the budgets that they have to work are expanding, which are allowing them to use things like orchestras and things like that. The music is dramatically changing for sure.
There's a couple of other themes throughout this volume, and actually some of them began before. But you write a lot about women in the music business, both as artists and in other aspects of the music business, basically getting the shaft. I mean, women just really had to work hard to be known.
Yeah, there's a lot. We talk about systemic racism, but there was systemic sexism, obviously. And it's just the way it was. But it was beginning to change. I know the 70s are when feminism really kind of comes to its fore, but you can see it arising in the 60s. And it begins with the arrival of oral contraception.
That's right.
That frees, and also playing back, I just kind of have to do this, but back to World War II, where all these men are off at war and the women are running the show at home. And when the men come back, the women are kind of like, well, wait a minute, I had income, I had some freedom, I would like to have some more of that. So there is this influx of women into the workforce in the post-war years, and that flourishes up into the 1960s. Birth control gives them some freedom over their lives, but they're still confronting a system really kind of is working against them. Sandy Shaw, one of my favorite artists from this era, is an early kind of, you know, pushback. She's pushing back. Her manager had come out of the old days when it was the casting kind of thing. You did what you were told and you all the way. And she's starting to push back and she's saying, I don't want to work with that photographer anymore. I don't want to work with this person anymore because of the sexual harassment that she's experiencing. Also, the legal system. There's a whole big thing when she's about to represent Britain at the at Eurovision. There's a whole section in this book about the origins of Eurovision in the 60s. But she's about to go off and represent Britain at the Eurovision. And there's this court case where she's identified as the other woman. And the judge at the case just reprimands her because he says, you know, women, you think you have the rights to do anything, you know, you're spoiled. You know, it was that kind of attitude. She's pushing back against that, but so is Dusty Springfield.
Oh yeah,
Dusty Springfield, you know, makes the bold choice to come out and say, well, you know, I'm attracted by both women and men, and that kind of derails her career for a while. Pop music, I think, is fun, but it's also important. Pop culture in general. Pop culture is where new ideas are brought out and tried out, and culture looks at them and says, hey, is this an interesting idea? Should we do this? Is this right? Often there is deep, deep, you know, values in a society. Sexism is deeply embedded in many societies. And women have to push back at us. And in pop culture, it's women that are pushing back against that. Men are resisting that. But you can also see this, you know, in the Beatles. Norwegian Wood.
Right.
Norwegian Wood is, John is singing about this affair he's had. But the end of the song, he burns down the apartment.
I know.
Because she's rejected him. And Paul McCartney has commented and said, well, that's because that's what we thought at that point in time. John Lennon, I think that one of the things we can also see about this transition in the 60s, we can see through John Lennon. He starts off, he's a sadist in many ways. He really degrades women, beats them up. He admits he was a beater. But by the end of the 60s, he's been converted. He's now pro-feminism. And at Yoko, I know there's people listening right now are going to say, oh, no, not Yoko Ono.
Yeah, but she really did change it. She really pushed him along in that line.
She did. And actually, and not only in that line, but also in how he thought about art and music.
Right.
She really needs a better attention by pop music fans. She gets demonized.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Gordon Ross Thompson, professor emeritus, Skidmore College, and he's taught classes on the musics of India, popular music culture, and media studies. And tonight we're continuing our conversation about 60s British pop outside in, this time Volume 2, Ichiku Park, 1964 to 1970. You know, another thing that happened during this era in Britain, and it's alarming. I remember when it happened, but it's alarming to review it. Police actions and censorship happened, and I'm specifically thinking about this, Mick Jagger and company. But really, there was an attempt by the government to sort of try to curtail this.
Oh, yeah. Well, not just, Jagger and Richards, but also Steve Marriott from the Small Faces gets arrested almost exactly the same time. And there was this one individual in the police force who was making a career for himself, arresting and convicting pop stars, even as he asked for their autograph.
Right.
And then the BBC, of course, is pushing back against the pirate radio stations. They're beginning to ban pieces of, well, they've always were banning pieces of music, but banning A Day in the Life, for example, because they didn't like the reference to Turn You On. They'd suddenly realized that there might be a drug reference there. There is a pushback. It's interesting also, you see Keith Relf from the Yardbirds complaining about the government and police action against youth. It was real. Because you have to think about that generation, the generation that's born during the war and in the post-war years, the Bulge generation in Britain. In 1968, the core of the Bulge generation turns 21. At 21, they can vote. At 21, they can legally sign contracts. And suddenly they have some power and authority. And that scared a lot of folks in the establishment, because suddenly you've got this massive population that is now going to be able to vote change the status quo. They didn't realize, of course, was that generation was also going to be kind of conservative. So by the time we get into the 1970s, we're into Margaret Thatcher and that whole scene. But that's one of the things they're afraid of. The whole scene around the pirate radio stations is fascinating. About these entrepreneurs are going up and setting up on boats and gunnery platforms and setting up equipment, and the fights between them. There's a murder at one point, armed gangs invading each other's territory. It's a fascinating scene altogether. And at the core of it is the right to be able to play music. This music that teens, the Bulge generation, who is now turning 20 and 21 and starting families, that's also going to change things. All of that is changing so dramatically at this point in time.
There's so many stories in this volume, so many. And I just want to pick out one that really fascinated me, Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah.
who was American, went to Britain, and what happened to him there?
Yeah, I know some folks would say Jimi Hendrix and a book about British pop. But yeah, here's this guy who's been through the R&B scene in the United States, backing up artists like Sam and Dave and those folks. And here he comes to Chaz Chandler sees him at a club in New York City, and says, "Oh, this is really special. I'm going to bring him to Britain." And then in Britain, they reinvent him. He's no longer the guy playing in the mohair suit in a backing band for an R&B singer. He's not going to be going psychedelic. His guitar skills are phenomenal. they pick out a British backing band for him. And Jimi Hendrix says, and I quote him in the book, when he's asked, "Is this an American sound?" And he says, no, this is a British sound. This is a whole thing that happens because he's in London. And he's working with British musicians and British audiences. And he comes into clubs and just blows people away. I was talking with
As you describe him, I think the British audiences were unprepared for what Jimi Hendrix became.
Absolutely. I was talking with a musician who was playing in the house band at the club where he was brought in the first night, and whose amp Jimi Hendrix plugged into. And he says, the room just went, just froze. because they listen to this guy, and he's up on the stage, and he's doing this crazy stuff on the guitar, and the guitar, and all of the bigwigs at the time, Eric Clapton and Jeff Beck, and all these folks are there, and they just, I think Jeff Beck's the one that said, "I totally had to rethink my playing after that night."
It's funny, because I was just listening to a live recording of him at the Monterey Pop Festival, not the one that you see in the film.
Oh, yeah.
And he was actually quite funny, too, on stage. At one point, he made a reference to seeing Bob Dylan's grandmother or something, and it's obviously she wasn't there. But speaking of Dylan was still a huge influence on several British musicians, but Hendrix took some of his key songs, and really, those are the versions you remember.
Yeah, and they're also the versions that Bob Dylan, in the Crossroads, Bob Dylan now does Crossroads. Not Crossroads, sorry, All Along the Watchtower.
Oh, yeah.
Like Jimi Hendrix, because he thought Jimi Hendrix's version was better. But, people should be forewarned. There's a lot of Bob Dylan in this book because he's influencing the Beatles. You've got Manfred Mann covering his songs, and he likes the way that Manfred Mann and other British performers are covering his songs. He really kind of makes that up. And then there's also, songwriters like Donovan, who are writing in their own way, but are definitely influenced by Bob Dylan. Songs like, Season of the Witch, for example.
Yep.
I refer to it not only his version, but also Julie Driscoll and with Brian Auger and the Trinity. That's a great recording and just kind of like captures some of the atmosphere of that time. But there's a lot of really just fantastic music in this era. It was hard to pare it down in the book.
We're going to run out of time. The Troggs and Wild Thing, that's another song covered by Hendrix. But I had never seen a photograph of the Troggs before until your book. What was that? It's like they like have skimmers on and matching costumes. I did not associate that with Wild Thing at all.
It's funny, there's also they're trying to come up with their own version of this. They're in some ways they're kind of like a Kinks, but just didn't quite catch the same didn't have quite the genius of Ray Davis. They start up. Wild Thing is kind of punk anthem almost, garage band anthem. They were portrayed. Well, here's the thing.
Out of time, so it's going to have to be short.
Okay, they're from the West Country. Popular perception in London is about the West Country is they're crude and old fashioned, and so the Troggs were dressed up and told to act politely like they're from the West Country.
Right. Now, I also want to kudos to you because I finally learned a lot about Bonzo Dog Doodah Band. I have the recordings, and I was always fascinated by them. They were, if people out there have never heard of them, pick up some of their recordings because they were amazing. And I'll tell you the other band was Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mitch, and Titch.
Yeah, a big band.
Zabadak.
Americans don't know anything about, it seems.
No.
There's another band doing these elaborate musical productions. And again, another band that has an American producer. And I'll leave that for that.
That was one of those things. The first time I heard Zabadak, I had no idea. I thought it was like a Muppets thing. I didn't know what was going on.
It could be a Muppets thing. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but Zabadak.
Zabadak. And Arthur Brown. That was such a huge hit here when that came out. But he was sort of like a one-hit wonder.
Yeah, talk about entrances. That's where he's playing at
the
Jazz and Blues Festival, and they have him lowered in by a crane. I mean, talk about an entry. Or playing at a club and experimenting with different headsets that catch fire.
I want you to say just a couple of words about Ichigo Park, because that's a song that I just love. I love the sound of that. Small Faces. They're changing up their sound. It's much more psychedelic. And that's just a wonderful song.
Yeah, great song. I would also point out that Tin Soldier, the follow-up behind that, is a phenomenal performance by Steve Marriott. And it doesn't have, the Ichigo Park has these references to Sleepy Spires and, stuff like that.
We really have to stop now. Because I can tell you right now, we could get off on a tangent. Talk about the book for
great.
My returning guest tonight is Gordon Ross Thompson. He's a professor emeritus, Skidmore College. He's taught classes on the musics of India, popular music culture, and media studies. And tonight, we're continuing our conversation about 60s British pop outside in, but we're talking about Volume 2, Ichigo Park, 1964 to 1970. Pick up both of them. They're an amazing read. Hey, Gordon, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks. It's great talking with you. I hope we can do it again.
I hope we do it. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Oh, the bridge of sights, to rest my eyes in shades of